Presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica, se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Jilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a una atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
Well, the Benchlands Phase 4 happened, and another, gosh, I don't know, 20 to 40 or 50 people got mowed away. Let's put it this way. They had to trek out or face citations or harassment from the police and all their property that they couldn't remove by noon Wednesday the 5th was demolished. Literally crunched, compacted, and tossed into a dumpster. And we got a lot of audio and commentary on that, as well as some of the preliminaries, and perhaps discussions as to what to do next, and a few other odds and ends as well. So stay tuned, and away we go. Also, we're looking for individuals who are either living in the Benchlands or want to help gather plaintiffs, that is to say, possible people to go to court and say, stop these sweeps because you're not providing adequate shelter, you're not giving us options, and you're violating the constitutional rulings of Martin versus Boise. This would be an operation run by the homeless folks themselves, to some extent, the plaintiffs, and with some help from folks outside. Folks outside could help gather these plaintiffs. If you're interested, give me a call at 831-423-4833. That's the latest project that Huffsters decided to get into, some of us anyway, at the latest Huff meeting today. Let's now begin the show.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So we'll begin with kind of some snapshots of the, I call it, I guess, the Benchlands resistance, or really its supporters of Benchlands resistance, since at this meeting there weren't any actual residents of the Benchlands there except toward the very end. This was held at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which has been the location where we've held a lot of these meetings. Initially, there were numerous people from the Benchlands coming, but as pressure increased and the sweeps started to happen, and there was sort of some talk of a lawsuit and then no talk of a lawsuit, and people didn't show up. Some did. Some folks did show up to assist people in leaving, carrying their stuff and so forth. But a relative handful of folks, a little more on occasion, but and this, I think, may have diminished the numbers. Plus, there was some talk of trying to repeat the Benchlands resistance as happened 2 years before. Well, it wasn't the Benchlands, it was the San Lorenzo Park resistance, where the community came out to support. And actually, they came out twice. First, they came out and they created barricades in San Lorenzo Park to stop Andy Mills police. And then that was swept away by the police, and the police came and essentially did the usual terror sweep tactics. Although there was, I don't know that there was any actual brutality in that particular sweep. But then 2 weeks later, when they did it again to finalize it, there was a massive appearance by the community, who actually blocked police and held them off in a way. Not just in a way, there were dozens of people there demanding the police leave or provide real places for them to go, which they weren't doing. And the next day there was an injunction that was granted by the Union of the Homeless, or by the judge who responded to the Union of the Homeless, and it held really essentially for about a year and a half. That was in December of 2020, and it's only, well, a year and three quarters. The injunction itself actually was dissolved about 6 months later, but the city continued to act as though the area was a sanctuary area, or at least a specific area designated by the city as appropriate to go to, that where people could be unmolested by police demanding them to move. In fact, the city stuffed the area with people from other encampments that it destroyed, I feel, in violation of the Martin versus Boise, don't do it unless you have a place for people to go that's indoors and a decent shelter without religious requirements and accessible and disabled accessible and so forth, which they didn't have as they did this. Instead, they threw people into a very crowded, increasingly crowded situation in the Benchlands, which is what they were doing as they, which they are doing, I should say, as they destroy slice after slice of the Benchlands, starting with the one nearest Water Street and then proceeding toward the Dragon's Head Bridge, if that's what you call it. It's got a dragon and that's got a head, so that's what I'll call it. That's the footbridge across the into San Lorenzo Park from River Street. So this latest meeting was, I guess it was last Friday, and it was an attempt to kind of mobilize people to assist, to discuss what's to be done next, to express their dismay and their concern. Ideally, I guess, to bring more people down, at least to document the kind of destruction that was happening. So really a lot of the credit for this meeting, and perhaps some of the blame, can be given to the credit, really, can be given to Elise, who organized the meeting on short notice, because there really wasn't. Keith McHenry had been organizing these meetings, but he was having increasing food shortage problems and other difficulties that was making it. I've quoted his problems and his concerns in past shows. He also is a lead officer in the Union of the Homeless, who have been gathering declarations or at least contact information for people who could be part of a lawsuit, and even got attorney Anthony Prince to come down to the Benchlands at one of the several meetings that were held down there, which actually was done at my suggestion. It's a good idea to actually do so, to see what the people actually want to do there, if anything. And it really has turned out that people are pretty much operating independently rather than together. They don't feel solidarity together, and they're just saving what they can of their own meager goods, or actually what they've accumulated over the year and a half in the park, depending on how long they've been there in the Benchlands. And then many of them are moving deeper into the Benchlands, but that is only a temporary solution, because the next week they go after the section that they've moved into and move them further and crowding further, and all the while claiming Jeremy Leonard and Chris Monteith all claim they have lots of space up at the Armory for anybody who wants it. And the only reason people are declining has to do with their fentanyl use, and he's got willing to put them into a drug program, the implication being, well, what the heck, why aren't they doing that? And that is disputed by Keith McHenry and others, who say not only are Armory conditions oppressive, but there really isn't room in there. And it's a violation of the Martin versus Boise decision anyway, because partially the shelter they're using isn't the Armory, it's outdoor shelter at the so-called Overlook. And it has to be indoor shelter, according to this Martin versus Boise, don't ticket unless you have an indoor shelter to go to. It also has to be done with a view to the entire group of people in an encampment which is a community. And although this is this a part of the Martin versus Boise decision, I'm not aware that it is in terms of this community aspect, but it certainly is a part of the reason people don't want to leave, aside from the fact the armory is far away, can only be accessed by a van, you're not allowed to go up there yourself, you're not allowed to have visitors in your tent, you're treated like a minor or a elderly incompetent in the sense that you have to obey rules that normal adults do not have to obey in their living quarters. And you're bossed around by people. At least that's the impression I got from some people. Now, this isn't what everyone says. Others say differently. Anyway, what I'm going to play for you now, though, is a bit of how folks were sort of struggling to organize. And this was about the fourth or fifth meeting around this issue. And it was essentially a contracting group of people, though there were more people there than I expected. I had expected very few. Partially because, well, the meeting was held on October 3rd, and at a previous meeting on Friday, again called by Elise in the Benchlands itself, only three of us showed up, and two of us were at one location, and one was another. It was completely disorganized. So it was, it seemed to show that we were in trouble in terms of trying to organize immediate emergency help. And I came with the idea of looking to get long-range support for folks, not just in the Benchlands' immediate demolition of Phase 4, which happened and was slated to happen 2 days later on the 5th of Wednesday at noon. But in the future demolitions, which were happening on a weekly basis, and which I was suggesting were likely, I believed, although I have no evidence for this yet, to continue against other encampments that would spring up in the Poganip and other parks and elsewhere in visible places, like the, you know, across from the town clock where there were in, earlier before COVID. And so that would be necessary to find some stronger tools and some better organizing connections with the community. And we had to do it over the long run rather than kind of do the push the panic button and try to bring everybody down every single phase that the city sliced off. Although I've tried to come to every one of those phases. I think I've generally made most of them. I made the last one. Yeah, I was there. I mean, it didn't seem to do much good. But actually, the last one, well, I'll be talking about that in the course of this netcast. So here's some of the conversation that we had.
All right, thanks, everybody. So the next one, and you can be the first to speak.
This is Elise.
Question.
Well, I do.
Okay.
An announcement, whatever.
Okay. I have you just under October 5th. This was the time when we might answer questions or field questions or put out questions, like if anybody has any big questions. I was hoping some people who are living in the Frenchlands would be here. And they might come late. How can we support people? How can we help people who might be staying and they want to stay there and they're saying they might not be leaving? That's secondhand information. Another question I had, the big question is, and I think you had contributed this a couple weeks ago, how do we stay in touch when our community is being dispersed? I mean, how can we, for example, I've been able to go down there and talk to people and meet people and get to know people. We've been having meetings down there. We're not going to be able to do that. That's just one thing. I was giving out some resources today. So does anybody have any really pressing questions? Because I more or less, these were just ideas. Yeah, Paul?
Well, I have two questions.
Yeah.
One question is whether anybody's been on the ground listening to the conversations between the police and the residents, because I'm not reading or hearing anything about resistance, you know, like notable resistance. And so I'm just wondering what technique the police are using to move them along. I'm imagining that they're saying, you can take your stuff and get out of here, or we're going to arrest you and your stuff disappears. But I don't know. And so that's my one question is, does anybody actually listen to those conversations and understanding the strategy that they're using to systematically dismantle what's down there? My other question is, how do people summon the energy, the motivation to help these people when I feel like they're not helping themselves? I look down there and I see these massive piles, multiple piles of trash. Mm-hmm. And I just, it's just like, it's hard for me to put my wrap my mind around that. Like, I just feel like, you know, I don't know what's going on. I don't understand that. Is it everybody has given up and they're just throwing these trash, you know? Or I don't know. I feel like if I was living there, I would make some effort. And maybe some people are making an effort. I'm sure some people are. But are the most of them not? Maybe I'll direct them.
Just put anybody, and I'll be really quick. So, I was there during the police were fairly patient. They waited. So, they waited until well after the noon hour when they were. But I'm just saying, I'm not saying this to be like all patting the police on the back. But at a certain point, they were coming in, and we were, at that point, we had a lot of people. It was a small group, but it was a good, solid group, helping people move up, get out of there, move down. So that's one quick answer. Jorge was defending himself and taunting police, but not in a really crummy way. Like, yeah, where's the crime here? You're the crime, is something pretty close to what he said.
Now, I think Elise is talking about the demolition of Phase 2. And that happened, I guess, around the end of September, continuing with this. And Jorge's arrest, when he was soon released, was the only arrest that I'm aware of that happened, at least in the first three phases. Don't think there was one in Phase 4 either, which happened this week on Wednesday. It will be yesterday.
Another thing he said is, we're the crime, destroying nature. So he was just basically talking, and he saw himself as engaging in civil disobedience, and at one point they put him in the police car. They took him to jail for about 4.5 hours. And I think that he was doing that because he really was empowered by the solidarity at the Benchlands, by the homeless union meetings here, so I wanted to say that. And I'll just quick answer to how do people help people who are... Perhaps you're saying not so willing to help themselves, or doing enough to move.
I just see a ton of trash down there. Whether it's the section that people moved out of, ton of trash. The people are still living. Ton of trash.
I have my own ideas about that. They're not factually proven. I think the city has not been picking up trash. I'm told. Jeremy told me, he's a big guy, by the way, he told me they go through every day and pick up trash. I just don't believe that.
No, he's lying.
He says a lot.
And so I don't believe that. Secondly, I've heard that some people are on drugs where that's part of the behavior to collect stuff. I think that's going on. The trash cans that I have seen are way down on Water Street, so they're nowhere near there. And just judging from my recent few minutes ago experience, which was... pretty sad, but I have to say I'm already sad because I had to pay rent today and scrape together some money. So I'm a little sad, so I can't blame it on them, but it's a bit demoralizing. And to add to that, one homeless band of people that I was reaching out to on Friday evening when we were going to have a meeting out there said, and a bunch of them said this, we don't want to have anything to do with that camp. Nothing anymore. Not at all. No, we are not affiliated. I mean, they just kept repeating that to me. And one of them is now one of the ones at the Armory who said to me that he enjoys it up there. So there's some quick answers to your question.
And I've heard a bit of that, too. Some weeks ago when I was doing Food Not Bombs interviews at the meal, the daily meal that happens 12 to 3 every day, Saturdays and Sundays included. Go and volunteer. They need your help. That there was this sort of fear and a loathing for the Benchlands, that it was a druggy situation, it was a dangerous place down there. I didn't hear a lot of specifics sort of justifying this, and I didn't really inquire into it in great detail, a little bit. But it seems like this is the narrative that is being spread And I think it's a misleading one. And I think Elise is sort of expressing the same feeling.
And I think that one of the ways that we keep up our motivation, just to round it off, is it's about vision and imagination. Like, not the kind of fantasy vision that isn't in touch with reality, but knowing that people need services, they're not getting services, the money is being spent on $250,000 for a legislative analyst to look up homeless bills and stuff. And not saying that's a bad thing, but where's the shelters that are being built? You know? So anyway, that's my answer. Anybody else? Since that was the pressing question that came forth, maybe we could stick with that, unless somebody has another.
Yeah, well, the thing is that the garbage... So they fired the guy that was collecting
Keith
the garbage
McHenry.
About 3 months ago, 4 months ago, that the city actually hired to come down there. So he's been gone for, I would say, at least 4 months now.
Now, I've heard conflicting reports on this, not about the firing or the hiring of the guy, but whether garbage is regularly picked up in the benchlands. And I don't know. Keith does go down there at least once a week, more frequently, a couple times a week probably more than I do. So he may have had, and he's very social with the folks and talks a lot to them, or so he reports. So I can't say.
About 3 months ago, 4 months ago, that the city actually hired to come down there. So he's been gone for, I would say, at least 4 months now. So there are, like, people down there that do their best to try to remove all the garbage. But, you know, they only have those little brown things to move things. And so then the other thing that happens is that people, like, and so somebody will come to their tent and find new people living in their tent. And then those people leave, and that area becomes just garbage because nobody is paying attention. So that's been something that's gone on. There was some slashing of tents by the police at one point.
I saw that.
Yeah. And breaking of things. They did that to Blue at one point early on. There is also does seem to be, I don't know so one of the things that they've been clever at is that the people they deem to be organizers, the people that are the most together and everything, they're giving them the best accommodations and promising them housing. Now, they'll probably never get housing, but that's their strategy. So we used to have this one woman, Paula, I think is her name. She came to all of our meetings here, super organized. They made sure she got like her own little tiny house over, and that's what they did with Greg. So all the key organizers got the little tiny houses over at the, at Housing Matters, so that they would be disempowered. So there's been a strategy of that. There's also been, I don't know how exactly this is happening, but right before some of our meetings, I would go down there, and I've never would see, and I'm there all the time. So all of a sudden, one day I go down there, and there's like 30, 40 people doing meth with the tin foil and everything. And you're just like, whoa, I'm down there all the time. I never see like 30, 40 people at the, all at once doing it. So that's been a common strategy. We saw that with the breakup of the Tent City protest in San Francisco, where the police came and handed out free speed to everybody until it just unraveled.
And indeed, Keith discussed this some couple months ago, maybe, or many weeks ago, and I was a little skeptical, but then I heard it from a second source that there was this sort of long line of people publicly smoking something new that had arrived in the benchland. So I would credit this account.
So that's not uncommon strategy. That might be what's happening. In part. So there's all kinds of combinations of strategies occurring. And it'll be interesting to see how long people will stay happy at, some people do like the army and stuff. A lot of people like it at the beginning until they get into a fight with the management that kicked them out. Some people get at first it's okay to go there, you know, meet the vanity, not be able to come into town until 7. But then they lose, the, you know, then that becomes too, really constricting. Other people just plain won't put up with being there from 8 to, at night till 7 in the morning. Okay. Things like that. You can't bring, all, you know, small amount of belongings and so on. There's many levels of what is happening.
But now, as is usual, here's a musical break before we continue. I'm not sure whether we're going to hear more of this, which is, I think, interesting and enlightening to some extent. But I got a lot of stuff to play, so we'll see where we go. So this is going to be Peter Gabriel's song, Games Without Frontiers, and I'm going to spout the lyrics first, so just in case you miss some of them, you get more of them. A one, two, four, Jeux sans frontières. That's Games Without Frontiers in French. Hans plays with Lotta, Lotta plays with Jane, Jane plays with Willie, Willie is happy again. Suki plays with Leo, Sacha plays with Brit, Adolf builds a bonfire, Enrico plays with it. Whistling tunes, we hide in the dunes by the seaside. Whistling tunes, we're kissing baboons in the jungle. It's a knockout. If looks could kill, they probably will. In games without frontiers, war without tears. If looks could kill, they probably will. In games without frontiers, war without tears. Games without frontiers, war without tears. Jeux sans frontières. Jeux sans frontières, jeux sans frontières. Andre has a red flag, Chang Ching's is blue. They all have hills to fly them on except for Lin Te Tieu. Dressing up in costumes, playing silly games, hiding out in treetops, shouting out rude names. Whistling tunes, we hide in the dunes by the seaside. Whistling tunes, we piss on the goons in the jungle. It's a knockout. If looks could kill, they probably will. In games without frontiers, war without tears. If looks could kill, they probably will. In games without frontiers, war without tears. Games without frontiers, war without tears. And then there's a repeated Jeux sans frontières.
We're hiding the tunes by the seaside.
So far? We have heard that they had recently.
Gloria brought in an article today that's dated about a week ago that says there's still, if I'm reading the article right, there's still like 50 something beds.
And of course, Jeremy Leonard, who's sort of the city's man on the scene, insists that there are beds available and anybody who wants can get one. And he. And also, and he keeps repeating this, and I guess I keep repeating that he does. He says, anyone who wants can get into a drug program. He'll help them personally to do that. I don't have any personal stats on this. And that's, of course, something we need. And in addition to looking for plaintiffs, we're looking for people who want to keep a steady monitor on these armory beds, so-called, or armory spaces and tents, indoors and out, and the outlook spaces, because clearly there aren't enough for everyone if you consider the group that is being dispersed in the benchlands, to say nothing of the many people throughout Santa Cruz who continue to be homeless and under threat of arrest or harassment or property seizure by the police.
If I'm reading it right.
And just to point out that all those beds were filled before the sweeps, and they kicked everybody out and told them to go to the benchlands, and then they now are being put back in. So essentially there's 100 people total.
Could I get these back?
40 kicked out of Oceana into the benchlands, and then the 60 kicked out of the armory into the benchlands.
Okay.
And now they are putting those...
Hell's Trail.
Huh?
Okay.
Hell's Trail will kick out.
Yeah, but that's not part of... Yeah, that's not... But Hell's Trail was not an official city facility.
Okay.
No.
So anybody right. else want to address this question that Paul raised? And it's a question of morale. I just think it's really good. Like, I told you about Jorge listening to people in the police. What is the strategy of the police? One of the things they did, I just want to add this really quick, is on this third sweep, I just felt like they were more... brutal about like snapping the tent poles, and it may have been who was in charge. I wasn't there during the actual sweep, but I was there in the aftermath.
Now I played some audio of that third sweep, which was the sweep of phase three that happened, I guess it was on the, it's in late September, it was either Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday, I think it was Monday, last Monday in September or thereabouts. And you heard some very passionate commentary by Troy and Mama Shannon. If you listen to the Sunday Net show that I played, it's archived on the Huff website. So I tend to concur that there was it was far more. I mean, I personally faced Lieutenant Carter Jones telling me that I'd likely be arrested. I'd be arrested. I couldn't go into the area to help people move their possessions after the noon deadline, that everyone had to leave. Although, as I said in that audio that I made of that, and I played some of in the last show, the police did allow people who were already in there to take their stuff out, but they did not allow them to come back and continue to do it. Whereas in yesterday's demolition, they did, to some extent, although they were also discouraging people from coming back. And anyway, here's some more of our own preparations trying to figure out what to do.
And people were looking for purses, looking for this. They were in amidst all this stuff. Also, we didn't have support, which this week before that, Cecil and Rip and Grayson and a lot of people came in to help. A woman named Sarah and others, Nora and myself. People were, it wasn't a huge group, but it was enough and it was significant. It really helped people to get the help they needed to get their stuff out of the way. But I felt like the last sweep, we weren't there, and it was, I feel, more demoralizing. Whether I'm right about that, it was just more, and so again, it could be subjective. I came there at the end. Anybody want to make more comments on this? Because I feel it's a difficult demographic to organize and to maintain morale. It can always be difficult in campaigns to maintain morale. Some are tougher than others, and I think this is a tough one. Keith has been pretty great at it. Yeah, James.
So during the first one, I was having some dialogue with an acquaintance that was actually helping to be cleaned up. So the last sweep, I was there early in the morning, and really not much was going on. A couple people were moving stuff out. It came maybe an hour and a half later. I was doing some other stuff. Still, there was not very much activity for the area that was there. Then I had to go to work for a couple hours. Came back and witnessed what appeared to be law enforcement being... I witnessed what I saw them cutting up and breaking stuff. And it seemed like very few of the tents were actually packed up and moved. And there was a small tractor that was just grabbing stuff very slowly, maybe five or six individuals grabbing and separating things. But I came back that evening, and they had done quite a bit. And the next day, I was curious, and I talked to somebody, and I walked around and by the river, just I hadn't ever walked there to see if I could go through. I was wearing an orange shirt. I wasn't trying to hide from the tractor guy. And he's like trying to shoo me away. He gets out of his vehicle. And he's talking to me. And I'm like, dude, I'm a reporter. Do whatever you need to do. You just think I'm trespassing. I don't think I'm trespassing. And I'm like, just do what you got to do. So I walk around and I'm coming back. And he still hasn't started his machine. There's probably at least 12 law enforcement there. So I just walk to the railing. And I just waited. I'm like, God, they're going to notice that I'm there. You know? And they did.
Phase three, you're talking about?
So one last week. Is that phase three?
No, it's phase two.
Okay, so that's phase three. And so I had a cordial conversation with the one officer that addressed me. There were two that were in the background, but they know who I am. You know, they know who I am. And he kind of gave me his warning, whatever, and I said, dude, I'm not going to argue with you. I heard you, hurt you. I heard what you said. I'm aware of what you said. So, you know. So it seems like there's a lot of good cop, bad cop. Mm-hmm. And I witnessed some stuff that wasn't very positive. I could say more of that physical vicinity and some of the frequency weapons that are right there in that area that have affected me personally, but that's another subject, and most people don't realize that our phones and the other things are actual frequency weapons. So it seemed like the people are pretty subdued. I made two more walks, and it's just, I witnessed a bunch of people. I wasn't sure what they were smoking, because I don't do that. But I witnessed a lot of people doing stuff like that, and I just walked by.
So since I got last week, was like, first the cops come through with kind of that sense of like, oh, we're here to help you, like passing out garbage bags, and like, all right, folks, your soft warning, you know, like trying to be soft like that, and then they show up with bulldozers. And so, like, when you see a bulldozer, I think that's kind of all the pushing you need. But some people, I think a lot of people are kind of waiting to the last minute, just because it's like they're always in this reactive mode. But mainly people are tired. People are just really tired, that's what I noticed. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I've been feeling that too, that like, oh, my gosh, this is so much, that's been like kind of buoying me up is when I'm down there, people's gratitude and their solidarity with each other, of like helping each other move, like helping each other pack stuff up, And then, like, intense gratitude when we show up to help move. So that's, I don't know, it's small, but that's the thing that keeps me going, I guess. And that, like, people are, they're really trying to do their best, even if from the outside it just looks like a pile of trash. It's like, they're doing their best, you know. And I try to leave that at the core. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What time, which of the phases were you?
Well, last week I was there like 8:45 to maybe like 10:30 or so. So, the cops were just starting to come in around 9:30. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So glad you're there. It's great that people can be there.
Yeah, I'm a no. It was so discouraging. I didn't go down, and I can't lift anything, so I felt like I'm just going to be a bummer. But then, I don't know if we're at this part of this thing, but now people have moved to places, and it seems like there's a pretty. I haven't gotten the details, but at some point we want to find out what really is where they've moved. You know, so JP told me that he was moving to Highway 9. That could be in a lot of things. I'm not sure what the details are of that, but it seems to me as the homeless union, one of the things we might want to be organizing around is figuring out how to get, see what is not, yeah, it's very complicated because it would be good, it's good before the floods for everybody to get out of the bench lands. But there was water there and there were toilets there. Now there's no water, now there's no toilets. And there's no, I'm sure JP will set up a new kitchen wherever he's at if he's in a large community of people. So maybe then the next thing we can do is to start bringing resources to the new camp. So like we could potentially get we canceled the pallet of food for the benchland the last 2 weeks, but we could potentially do a pallet of food that we take to a camp if it's big enough to really qualify for a whole pallet worth of food, and we could start to do something like that. Maybe a some kind of effort to get a portable toilets there. We did that before, where we rented portable toilets ourselves. The city took them from us, but maybe because this is like, you know, that might be something we can do.
At De La Vega too, a lot of people saying they're going up there.
Yeah. Yeah, so I haven't seen a lot of people up there, although because I drive out there several times a day, but that might be possible. Like to
where is this camp?
And there was some sensitivity mentioned, not by any campers who were there, but by those who view themselves as their advocates. They didn't want to reveal the presence of encampments where they might be, so that would possibly enable the police to go after them. I think probably that concern is a little premature, given the fact that the city has its hands full going after people in the benchlands. But, you know, I'm going to kind of roll over any discussion of where camps were located currently. If you want to really get involved in that, you have to, of course, earn the trust of the people in the camps. I mean, they're not actually that hard to find, because people... I guess some are, but many are not. If you keep your eyes open, you'll see them. And if you want to offer help, you can offer help. Of course, the benchlands still exist, and there's a place to offer help. As I said, the next eviction demolition is going to be on Tuesday the 11th at 9 o'clock in the morning, according to the postings.
So that's the thing, is to figure out where the largest camps are, and maybe provide support for the material support for them.
The assistant to the city manager was quoted in the paper as saying that they were not going to permit any more large encampments.
Yeah, so. Of course they're saying that, yeah. And a large encampment to them may be a very small encampment.
Yeah,
from
right.
Our point
you
of view.
Right. By that, yeah. But encampment.
Yeah.
Eliminate.
And then the other thing is to... Sergio was really angry today, and I finally got his details, but they went into the camp and arrested them, took them out, held them 5 days, I believe. And so he got trespassing charges for being in the camp. They claimed that there had been a stay He said that Jeremy Leonard went and got the cops to have him taken out, claiming that he had a stay-away order. So Jeremy Leonard actually, sadly, does have the power to make a stay-away order, but it's unlikely he actually told Sergio that he had done that and maybe did not do that. And
so it's about time for another musical break, and break we will.
Sing about love and war. I don't really know what I'm saying. I've been in love and I've seen a lot of war. Seen a lot of people praying. They pray to Allah and they pray to the Lord. And mostly they pray about love and war. Thank you. about love and war. I don't really know what I'm saying. I've been in love and I've seen a lot of war. Seen a lot of people praying. They pray to Allah and they pray to the Lord. And mostly they pray about love and war. Pray about love and war. Pray about love and war. Love and war.
And that was Neil Young. Love and War. So let's break up the organizing planning. If I can get this mic to work. It's a little hard. I think that works. With an article in the, looks like the October 5th Chronicle, State Decriminalizes Jaywalking by Dustin Gardner. That's one of the things they used to ticket me for. Though I've never been taken to jail for jaywalking, I think other activists have here in Santa Cruz. Steve Argue, for one, some years back. Governor Gavin Newsom on Friday night signed a bill that will decriminalize jaywalking in California, except if the pedestrian crossing the road is in immediate danger of being hit. AB 2147 by Assemblymember Phil Ting, Democrat of San Francisco, prohibits police officers from stopping or citing people who cross the street outside of a crosswalk, quote, unless a reasonably careful person would realize that there is an immediate danger, unquote, of a collision with a vehicle or a bicyclist. Ting and supporters of the bill said bans on jaywalking are often disproportionately and arbitrarily enforced against people of color and lower-income individuals. Ting said police will no longer be able to use jaywalking as a pretext to detain someone. It should not be a criminal offense to safely cross the street, Ting said in a statement. When expensive tickets and unnecessary confrontations with police impact only certain communities, it's time to reconsider how we use our law enforcement resources and whether our jaywalking laws really do protect pedestrians. The bill takes effect January 1, 2023, so not yet, folks, and is Ting's second attempt to decriminalize jaywalking in the state. Newsom vetoed a similar bill last year because he said he worried it would encourage people to cross streets unsafely when California already has a high rate of pedestrian fatalities. The Democratic governor didn't include a message when he signed the bill Friday night, hours before a midnight deadline to sign or veto bills approved by legislators this year. Ting's office said there are many cases where police stops over jaywalking have led to violent and deadly outcomes, particularly for black people. Police stop data compiled by California's Racial and Identity Profiling Act Board shows black people are up to 4.5 times more likely than white people to be stopped for jaywalking. And that State Decriminalizes Jaywalking by Dustin Gardner. And indeed, I've been stopped a number of times and given citations for jaywalking. Once, actually, next to the crosswalk on Pacific Avenue. Once across Mission Street after a huge protest in which there were no cars coming because they were all blocked by police barricades. That was in the largest anti-war protest that Santa Cruz has had since the Vietnam era. I can't speak for the Vietnam era because I wasn't here then. But on 2003, in March, after Bush moved in with his schlock and awe, here in Santa Cruz, there were, I think, some people counted 6,000 people out on the streets, which is the largest number I ever heard of doing that, at least in modern times, in the last 20 or so years. And I was coming back, and I got stopped for jaywalking. I remember, I think I took the case to court, and if I can remember how that one turned out, and I'll try to put on my thinking cap on one of these future netcasts and maybe or dredge up some of the old records and see what happened. I just remember how outrageous it was and how witnesses agreed. But police seemed to be very enthusiastic about giving me the ticket. And so now I guess they can still do so. I'm not sure what they would claim. Jaywalking won't be as good a pretext. Maybe it was punishment for being in a anti-Bush protest. Ironically, the wars are continued by Obama and Biden, so it doesn't really matter who the big Führer is. Both these parties are leading in the same direction. Then, of course, there was another gloomy, very gloomy story in the October 5th Sentinel. Scotts Valley High teens accused of stomping head of homeless man by Jessica York. Police have arrested two high school students in connection with a serious assault on a homeless man in Santa Cruz. They detained two students, minors whose names were not released due to their age, shortly before 11 a.m. Monday at their Scotts Valley High School campus, according to Captain Scott Garner. Arrests were in connection with what happened, or what was described as an elderly male battered shortly before 8:30 p.m. Friday on the 1400 block of Ocean Street, according to a Santa Cruz Police Department media log. The teens, including a 14-year-old Santa Cruz resident and a 16-year-old Scotts Valley resident, were booked into juvenile hall on suspicion of felony assault by means likely to cause great bodily injury. Witnesses to the attack, according to Jessica York, described seeing three juveniles attacking a man and stomping, quote-unquote, on his head, according to a Santa Cruz police release. Investigators later obtained video showing the assault victim running away from the juveniles on Ocean Street before they struck him down and then fled in a vehicle. The 53-year-old man was transported to the Bay Area Trauma Center in critical condition for treatment of head injuries. On Tuesday, Santa Cruz Deputy Chief of Police John Bush said the beating victim remained in the hospital recovering from his injuries but was conscious and speaking. Bush dispelled rumors of the man's demise, a thread that had run rampant on social media since the teen's arrest. Homelessness services provider Brent Adams, who operates the nearby Footbridge Services, or at least what remains of the Footbridge Services, I add, at the end of Felker Street, said the injured man was one of his clients. He, too, told the Sentinel that he had heard the man was deceased. On the night of the attack, one of my clients arrived asking for a change of clothes because she had blood all over her for trying to save him, Adams wrote in an email to the Sentinel. Another client reported to trying to fight the attackers. Adams described the injured man as an unbelievably sweet person who regularly did odd jobs for Footbridge Services and businesses in the neighborhood. Adams said that the man, though homeless, had longtime connections to the Santa Cruz community. And that's an October 5th story by Jessica York. Scotts Valley High teens accused of stomping head of homeless man. So about 2 days before the last sweep, I guess that would have been on the 3rd, I visited the San Lorenzo Park area, wandered around, and this is what I found myself muttering. Well, it's October 3rd, 2022. That's a Monday morning. I'm at the San Lorenzo Park at about, I'm guessing, 8:30, maybe a little later in the morning. Looks like the duck pond fountain is rolling. The ducks are restored. Well, there's some lily pads without any lilies. They look like spinach plants inside the duck pond. Massive chain link fences around all the grassed areas. And some folks on the path. What's cooking here. I'm here talking to an individual who prefers not to be named, who's telling me that the problem here is a lack of solidarity, and what good is a park without people? I mean, you know, some rather obvious things are being said, but, you know, why not...
They got the playground closed, right?
And why not say them again, so...
Kids can't play.
Thank you, man. Take care. And that's a guy who's from the upgoing phases. Morning. Morning. You got some stuff with you, I see.
Yeah.
Moving out or staying here?
Just walking around.
That's a good idea. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I'm on the path walking past the porta potties. Very congested area with. And that's the path that is above the Benchlands. It leads to the county building. that sort of intersects with the footbridge path that leads all the way to Dakota Street. And that's where all the porta potties have been moved from the benchlands all the way up into that area, kind of all next to each other. So you can have a cozy time in the porta potties with other people taking a dump nearby. Lots of tents, not just in the uncleared, that's a nasty way of putting it, areas of the flatlands I'm looking over here as I walk, but also on the rise. And here I'm talking as I walk along the path, looking down into the benchlands and also looking into the area that is a slope between the path and the benchlands. That between the path and the benchlands, there's kind of piles of debris that are left behind, as well as tents, areas covered with tarps, bicycles, and so forth. Or one anyway, as I pass by. See the stairway that there are two stairways, each enclosed with fences. And morning. And then, of course, there are the areas that have already been cleared. This is the Phase 4 area, which has, again, the last two walkways down enclose the area, or kind of circumscribe the area that's about to be cleared. If you can follow all that, you get a gold star. I mean, what they've done is they've generally started eliminating people by putting up a fence next to each of the stairways in succession. So they started with Water Street, and they set up a fence next to the first stairway down into the benchlands, and everything between that fence and Water Street got cleared, that is to say, demolished, people forced out, their property destroyed unless they'd picked it up by the one-week deadline. They did the next phase, two, by setting up another fence next to the second stairway, counting from Water Street, and did the same thing. And then the third, ditto, and finally the fourth most recently. And the fifth is, I'm not sure if there's one more stairway that goes down or if they simply arbitrarily put in a fence enclosing about somewhere between 30 and 50 tents. I'm not sure how many there are, but that's due to go next Tuesday on the 11th at 9 o'clock. Anyway, let's continue with this walk through the benchlands. This was 2 days before the Phase 4 destruction. Soon, I don't know if there are any notices. Anybody know when this area is supposed to be, mowed down? Yeah, I thought it was Wednesday noon, but
that's about right.
But I'm not sure.
They're really plowing at it. They're going to do it pretty quick.
Are you a resident?
No, I'm both kind of stay up here because I'm getting homeless.
I got you. A quick interview for free radio?
Yeah.
Okay, it's we're talking with
Daryl Lemoyne.
And Daryl, you're here on the path, kind of we're at the last fence before, I mean, sorry, the last stairway before the fence, the area that's already been cleared and the area that is yet to be cleared. The fence demarcates that. The stairway is in the area where you can still walk down into an area that hasn't been, that people are still allowed to live in. How long have you been outside?
It's been 18 months.
And where have you been, mainly, if you wish to say?
At the Armory up here.
How is it up there?
It's really nice. Yeah, they treat you really good.
How long have you been at the Armory?
I was there like 8 months, then I had come down to
morning
in town to live in one of the shelters at a motel, Ocean View.
Mm-hmm. And how did that compare with the Armory?
It was nice. It's kind of the same. They kind of family-supported, and the workers are like the people up there. They're spiritual people, so they treat you with respect, you know.
And has the Armory living situation changed between the time you were there before and the time after when you came back?
Yeah, now they say that people are indoors in tents, where before they had a big outside tent. They put up a temporary one, but it was big, mm-hmm. and they had little pods that people slept in.
And were the pods were, how much space was there in each pod?
It's pretty big. It's like a probably 18 by 30.
And how much space do you have now?
I'm not sure. I'm going back up today, so I'll find out.
And you've been outside the armory for the last few days?
About the last about 3-4 months.
And what kept you from returning to the armory until now?
I had to do some jail time because I had done some stuff in the past, and so I did that, and I guess still got to finish that off. But I'm going to go up there until I go to court again, and work towards getting a job again and get reintegrated and be part of the citizens again.
When did you get out of jail?
I got out of jail. Gosh, it's been 3 months, and I went to a recovery center for a while. It worked out okay about 47 days, and then it just something triggered me, and I ended up going back out.
We're talking drug or alcohol or just...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And how are people doing when you were in the recovery center? Did you have much connection with the folks in the recovery center who were doing the same thing?
They were... Because of the COVID thing, they're really stressed, and they couldn't get us to meetings, you know, AA meetings and NA meetings, and so it made it tough. It was kind of like a chalkboard school type thing, but it didn't apply really to getting back outside and getting into your own recovery and going to AA, NA, and getting a sponsor. So it's good for a certain point, but then you have to learn how to get back into society and be part of it, you know. And that's where it failed, I think. Not completely failed, but a person would leave there and they had no idea how to get back into society and be a part of it. So once you're, it's kind of like the old days, they used to call them spin dries, you know, 30 days in and you get back out and you don't have any experience being with recovery people, because out here and being a citizen is fine and working, but if you don't know who to hang out with, and the temptations are too big, you know. They're too great, and you start stressing out, and an alcoholic addict, they go right back to something that takes the stress away. And that's kind of almost automatic. It's almost a knee-jerk reaction, you know. And so, but once you start establishing really good meetings, I know myself, I would go to frontline meetings. That's where the people are just freshly getting, you know.
Pretty acquainted
with
that.
And then I step study meetings. And like for a man, you go to a men's meeting because they kind of teach you how to redress again and how to talk, you know, and all those things are really important, because as an addict, you throw all that stuff out of the window, you know, and you start learning the streetwise ways instead of being in society. And so those men's meetings really helped me a lot. I did it before. I had 5 years, and they taught me how to talk again, how to, you know, and be completely different. It's very uncomfortable when I went in there. My sponsor goes, "Oh, that's the exact meeting you need, because that uncomfortableness is the stuff you threw away." And they'll teach you how to be disciplined, you know, and how to talk and how to dress. All those things you don't think of, you know. You think, "Oh, the guy clinging sober, I'll just, you know, fit back in." Now you don't, because when you're out there doing that kind of stuff, you lose all that stuff that society had taught you, you know.
How were the facilities in the recovery center for living? I take it there was a housing?
Salvation Army is really good about getting you housing. There, most people couldn't get clean and sober housing, because it's once you get out, especially with COVID now, that's a big problem. There's no opportunity really to get them. Not very many people get into clean and sober housing. They end up back in the streets again. And
now, were you housed during the time you were in recovery?
Yes.
And that was sort of temporary housing in a dorm, or what kind of housing?
Like a dorm, yeah. Smaller, but like a dorm. Mm-hmm. And it was good, but once you got out of the program, there really wasn't any opportunity to get for finances to get into a clean and sober house.
Mm-hmm. And so you're going to reapply to the armory?
Yes, I'm going to reapply there and apply myself to doing what they ask of me, and then I'm going to go back to meetings and get a sponsor.
You've been out for 3 months. out of jail and you you didn't choose to go to the armory, why was that?
Oh, they were full then. I talked to them. They said that they were full, but now they're getting spots. You put your name on a list, they'll come out and get you when they have openings, you know.
And have you been gotten yet?
Yeah. I talked to them. They said either Monday or Tuesday I'll have a...
Today being Monday.
Today Monday. I have an opportunity to get in.
Sounds good.
They're really supportive. They're almost like a recovery place in a sense, because they want you to go get, you know, work or, you know, get your health in order. And they give you suggestions where to go, you know, what to do. If you take them, they'll support you a lot.
And so have you been living at all in the Benchlands?
Well, I say up here.
On the path.
Yeah, on the path.
And have you been, how has it treated you being on the path?
Really good. I mean, these people here, kind of, they all take care of each other, you know. So you feel kind of safe here, you know.
I mean, I don't see a lot of people, at least there are a few tents up there next to the porta potties. Are people sleeping around you usually? Is this where you're sleeping? Is this your spot here?
Yeah, people sleep up and down here quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And you feel safe because they're almost like family. They take care of each other, you know. They'll give you food or whatever you need, you know. They're pretty generous.
Now, has the demolition of these areas affected you at all?
Well, I guess because, yeah, the armory said that once they demolished this, they filled up real fast. They had like 30 people in one day. And so they said, you're going to have to wait another couple of weeks. And that's, I said, well, I've been out here almost a month. Yeah. I've been waiting to get back in there.
Mm-hmm. Has any of your property been taken, or you've been pretty lucky with that?
No, property taken. Not many major, but still, you know, we've got much.
You still have a sense that people look after each other?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, it's like anywhere else, you know, people, they rifle through your stuff if you're not present. And so you have to carry everything with you to make sure you don't lose anything. And when I got sloppy on that, went to use the restroom, I come back and stuff was gone, you know. But overall, it's been pretty good here. People really do take care of each other.
So, we have to use the restroom usually a number of times a day.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that situation? I mean, do you have people who will watch your stuff, or do you get lucky, or do you take it with you? What do you do?
You know, yeah, I take it with me and hang it inside the stall.
Relatively sparse possessional situation.
Yeah, that's it.
And, kind of minimalist.
Yeah, yeah. And relapse always leads to losing everything. it seems that way. But it's okay, because I figure, you know, they told me before, and they said, don't give up, and don't, because relapse, sometimes you can do that several times, and it's not uncommon. And the thing is not to give up. That's the key. And keep going to the meetings, even if you drink. They say go to the meeting because there's an energy there that's created with the people who are getting recovery. And it rubs off on you. And you start picking up their lingo and how they stay positive. They don't go negative. It's, you relapse. Don't dwell on it. Get up, dust yourself off, and get right back to work.
And we've been talking with, if you wish to say.
Oh, Daryl Lemoyne.
Thanks, Daryl. I'm Robert Norris.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Daryl.
Over here in Santa Cruz is good, too. They got some really good meetings. There's a lot of them. So,
what do you think of some of the people working, like Jeremy Leonard and Chris Monteith?
Oh, work where?
Who are they? They're in that building, and the tall fellow with the blonde hair.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They seem really nice. They're very supportive, too, because one gentleman came out from the courthouse and goes, he's talking to me. He goes, I was a meth addict for 20 years. I got through it. And he wanted to remind me, he goes, you can't go negative. You got to stay positive and get yourself up. Because he says, that negative stuff, I was kind of talking negative, telling me I really hate myself right now. No, no, don't do that. He goes, it happened to me. I relapsed, too, several times. He goes, but when I got it, and I got a job. I'm working now. And so he's a real good, he's an inspiration boy. I was like, it's a good reminder, because COVID kind of put everybody in isolation, you know. It did. And so...
Has Jeremy been able to give you any help?
He did. He he put me on a list for the armory, and he told me that he would make sure I got a slot.
And have you heard from him since then?
I once last week on Thursday, and he said he'd be here Monday or in Tuesday, and I could either go up Monday or Tuesday.
So you may be gone when I next come by.
Yeah, I'm hoping. And this time when I get the advice from Salvation Army,
right. Morning.
They just have a lot of people that really care. They just flat out care.
Right.
And they know people are, you know, use drugs and drink. You can't do them there. But they don't scold you for it. And they're as long as you're a gentleman or a lady, you know, they'll work with you.
And I wanted to note that he's not the only person who's had positive things to say about the armory program, although the management of the armory program did change from county to city use. I think that was also true of the Outlook. It was called, I guess, the Overlook. Well, one of the two. I'm always confused about those. But it was under county management for a while, and then it changed into city management. Of course, there have been very strongly divergent views about that program. Also, it could well have been that Daryl got into the armory, as Jeremy, according to him, had promised. Although I don't know. I didn't follow up on him, and I don't think... I hope I have more recent info in a subsequent netcast.
And you take their advice and the suggestions, and you actually apply them and do them, they'll really support you.
Thank you, Daryl.
Yeah, they're amazing. They were kind of a lifesaver to me because I was so far down the gutter, I was thinking about suicide. And they got me back on my feet.
Well, good luck at wherever you are, here or at the armory. And here, I'll give you my latest flyer here. You can. It's more about, I don't want to see the benchlands cleared until there's places for people to go. That's my theory.
Yeah, me too. That's been a big concern because there's so many of them. It's like, man, a lot of people are just getting displaced really fast. And that COVID really took a lot of people down.
Have you been sick?
No, never got sick. But I've seen a lot of people that had jobs, you know.
Yeah.
They go end up being homeless, and they've never been homeless before. It's like, wow. It's sad because they end up being discouraged, and you know.
I'm going to leave it there, man, because I'm going to roll. But
okay.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
My name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there, the laws to abide. And that the land that I live in has God on its side. Oh, the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charged, the Indians fell. The cavalry's charged, the Indians died. Oh, the country was young with God on its side. The Spanish war had its day, and the Civil War too was soon laid away, and the names of the heroes I was made to memorize. guns in their hands and God on their side. The First World War, boys, it came and it went. The reason for fighting I never did get, but I learned to accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side. The Second World War came to an end. We forgave the Germans and then we though they murdered 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now too have God on their side. I've learned to hate the Russians all through my whole life. If another war comes, it's them we must fight. To hate them and fear them, to run and to hide, and accept it all bravely with God on my side. But now we got weapons of chemical dust. If fire them were forced to, then fire them we must. One push of the button has shot the world wide. And you never ask questions when God's on your side. Through many dark hours, I've been thinking about this, that Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss. But I can't think for you, you'll have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on his side. So now as I'm leaving, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling, ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head and fall to the floor. That if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war.
And that, of course, was With God on Our Side, by old Bobby Dylan. Actually, young Bobby Dylan back in the early 60s. Now we got Greg Benson, who's been living in the Benchlands, but he's one of the activists who had volunteered to be a plaintiff. I think he's still volunteering, but and he has a residence in the Benchlands, but he has been creamed out, so to speak. That is to say, they have the authorities have offered him lodging elsewhere, and he has accepted it. He talks about that when you get to hear about that. You remember Keith McHenry was talking about how what the authorities are doing is they're trying to kind of buy off people who might be good activists or who were good activists and remove the motivation for them to do any more activism, which is sort of a traditional approach that authorities use in oppressed people's struggles, and it's quite understandable that people will accept some decent living arrangements for a while, at least. And who knows? It may not even deter Greg, but it will probably remove his need to be a plaintiff. Anyway, let's hear what he has to say. Today is October 3rd. I'm here in the RCN. Oh, that's the third.
Oh, it is.
Wow. The RCNV parking lot with Greg Benson, who's made it to the Benchlands Resistance meeting organized by Elise. And it's about 7:15. Greg, you recently moved into upper-class digs, yes?
There's a roof and plumbing, heat, electricity, a bed.
All the comforts of home.
It's crazy. It is crazy.
You've abandoned your role as a critic in the Benchlands.
Negative. I'm still in the same place. But it does, it takes a little bit of the fire out from under one's butt when you have comfort. And I admit that.
How long have you been in these comfortable circumstances?
One night.
Where are they? Well,
it's up at the Coral Street. It's called the Paul Lee Loft, but amongst that, there's no loft. It's the little tiny houses, the pallet houses.
How many of them are there?
Wow, a lot more than I knew there were.
Dozens.
Dozens.
Scores.
Dozens. I would say dozens, maybe. I don't know.
How many of them are vacant, any impression?
Very few are vacant. I know that one person went to jail that won't be coming back, and so somebody is already hovering over their spot, hoping to get that. I got into a four-bedroom trailer home kind of thing, which the lofts or the pallet houses don't have electricity, heat, ventilation. They're small, but it's a beautiful. But you have a lock on the door, which is amazing, and you have access to the bathrooms nearby and shower during certain times.
But you were telling me you.
I'm in a trailer home that I'm exceedingly blessed to have.
How many of these trailer homes are there?
There's a bunch, and there's different programs. There's one that might still be the RCC, which is like the Recuperative Care Center for people that, rather than staying in the hospital or just being kicked to the curb. And so there's maybe six people in one of those or two of those. I'm not even sure. I'm just I've got electricity. I've got a kitchen. I've got a bathroom. I have my own washer and dryer for, me and my roommates are people that I know, that I've known for years. I didn't know that I'd know them. I just, when I walked in, I saw somebody I didn't know that was still alive.
You had been living at the Paul Lee Loft for a while before you were transferred into the deluxe accommodation?
Oh, no. I just, I did my intake on Thursday, last Thursday, and was told, well, we're going to put you in the shared housing. And I was like, oh, no, like some giant, not that it.
It didn't sound good.
It didn't sound good. But then I realized, but you have electricity and you still have your own bedroom. I was thinking, honestly, I'd be happy with anything that was outside of the rain that had some sort of...
Now, before this, you were a resident of the Benchlands.
I'm still a resident of the Benchlands.
And so you have a vacation home in the Benchlands.
Exactly. And
haven't been moved yet. You haven't had your place demolished.
No.
Coming up in phase four or not?
We'll see.
I mean, are you in between two fences or not?
Not yet.
So maybe phase five, perhaps.
Yeah, and I'm actually in a zone that's between the water station and the charging station, and I have spoken with city officials to remind them, and I spoke with probation people to remind them that they had a little agreement that people were being released to that area because they were able to charge their devices, phones, ankle monitors, etc. And you don't just shut the power off when you've made an agreement with people's freedom at stake.
Now, are more people showing up who have been released from jail in the last couple of weeks that you've noticed in that area?
More? I don't know. I've noticed more just because people that I know, but I don't know if I wouldn't put a statistical...
I'm just wondering if they've slowed the passage of people because of the obvious apparent removal of folks from the Benchlands that will be happening again day after tomorrow, presumably, if they follow their approach.
I don't know. I mean, I wonder about that because a lot of people don't need to be in jail soaking up that amount of taxpayer money while not moving their life any direction, just frozen. So I really hope that... I hope this doesn't change things.
Many people returning to the Benchlands who have been moved out because of the demolition?
Yeah, we're condense and compress, and try to accommodate. You know, we're really, it's the beautiful thing about our culture out there, that my community of unhoused people is that, man, we've got people that hate each other's guts, but they're saying, hey, here's a spot for you. Here, we'll put up a little tent, or you don't have a tent. Here, I'll give you these tarps. We're going to make a spot for you. You're going to be okay.
In the last week after the influx of people from phase three.
Yeah, but that does not make it, that's, you know, you increase the population in a cage full of mice, and the mice end up killing each other, you know, the miricide percentage. That's a real thing. And the same thing occurs, you know, when we were able to self-select zones in the park, we were able to just kind of avoid those that we didn't, you know, agree with. And that kept tensions down. When they put us into, like, a gladiator arena circle or oval, that definitely, you could instantly feel the tension rising. And then when they kept closing more and more encampments, like Hell's Trail, etc., and telling them to come here, or they move the people from Depot Park, and the police lieutenant level actually said, hey, can you make sure you make some spaces for these people? And I was like, yep, do my best.
That's Lieutenant Jones you're talking about?
Nope, different lieutenant.
Okay.
But I just said a lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
I actually spoke with three different lieutenants that day. And they were all very...
amiable?
Very amiable and actually sincerely...
concerned with the welfare of the people in the Benchlands?
They honestly were. They were like, yeah. I have to say, you know, I mean, the cops see us in all of our glory. A lot of them, mature ones, and there's things I won't say that they've told me, from their personal opinions.
Secrets of the Santa Cruz Police Department?
No, just humans. Secrets of humans. Secrets of humans. And
secrets of men with guns, that sort of thing.
Guns and badges. But I'm happy that I'm here and not in the eastern portion of Ukraine. So
perhaps not in the middle of a raid from Attila the Hun, or possibly a concentration camp in Auschwitz, maybe at the bottom of the ocean.
I've been in places where we all need to keep that in mind. On both sides of that blue line, we're humans, and let's be human to each other.
You would be so advising Himmler and his company at the.
Nope. They went over the line. They lost their humanity.
For the purity of the German race, my son. Didn't you understand that?
Das verstehe ich glaube. Was? Excuse me, I just had something caught in my throat. Das habe ich nicht gesagt.
So, will you be at the demolition on Wednesday? Are you likely to be luxuriating in your digs, as I probably will be?
Probably be in the hot tub. Depends on... I'm not sure if they're even serving cocktails that morning at the hot tub. I don't know. I'll have to see. I probably might stop down to observe and to observe.
Sympathize.
The fine people from Cop Watch who are just outstanding in their... their readiness, willingness, and their steadiness, just being there. Abby and her crew.
Abby's abroad, right?
Is she?
I thought she was in Spain doing a walk.
That's probably true.
It's already happened and over and done with.
She hasn't been. Regardless, there are still Cop Watch people that come down and do very disciplined. Role of observing on form, on film, on video, observing police activity and doing it without, doing it so that it's admissible in court.
Now,
and
at the meeting, talking about court, you were suggesting that you might know some people who'd be up to be plaintiffs and who actually might be accessible in the next few days or weeks.
Yeah. I think it's almost essential that we find somebody. It just keeps, just for society at large, it's just essential that this adversarial system that we have.
Cuckoo, cuckoo,
cuckoo. That's the Keith.
Cuckoo, Keith.
That's Keith McHenry rolling by.
People's Tribune.
Yeah, I think it's important that we...
Well, I want you to get in touch with me if you can.
Yeah.
And because I can't reach you. You're occasionally, but only very occasionally, I've been able to reach you by phone. So, and I know that kind of goes with the territory. But since you now have somewhat more stable surroundings, might be better for you, and particularly if you can lock your...
I left my door open, and my phone charger did disappear off my Chester
George. All is not well at the Pauley Law.
Probably somebody. They probably just needed
a simple moment. Clerical error, perhaps.
Yeah, it's one of my buddies that probably
borrowed for the time being.
Yeah,
no doubt to returned later tonight.
I bet it will. I mean, these people are some amazing friends that I've had for a long time, and we've lost.
You have a bigger heart than I do there, Greg Benstrom. Thank you for talking with me. Is there anything you want to conclude with?
I just appreciate that Mr. Robert Norse comes out, shows up. I look for who's behind him, who is going to take up the mantle.
Greg Benson, of course.
As time goes on. Well, Greg's getting old, too. We need some youngsters.
Not that old.
And understand the potential of direct action and participating in the political process, showing up, staying in touch, reaching out, keeping an open mind, and staying active. Never give it up. Never surrender.
Thank you, Greg.
Love you, man.
So the meeting at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on
Monday the 3rd was sort of in prep for the upcoming October 5th demolition that happened on Wednesday at noon. And we're going to now kind of bounce ahead to then. There was some confusion as to whether it was going to be then or whether it was going to be earlier, because there was some concern that maybe we got our dates wrong, but it turned out to be noon. And here's some of the, well, I made my way to the Benchlands at noon with Gloria, running into other activists who were there. Not a lot, but some. I guess, I mean, there was a number of people on the path. I don't know how many of them were activists. And there were some folks generally really helping people carry their stuff out of the Phase 4 area up into the pathway. There was Lieutenant Carter Jones, I have to call him goon squad of cops, destroying tents and preparing it to be crushed, crunched, and just trashed, and doing his best to exclude people with a sort of, at least he may have learned something from the previous eviction where he was stopping me and others, and maybe he didn't learn anything, or maybe, I began at one point to call out angrily that it was responsible for destroying property that should have been put into storage by state law for 90 days. But he had no response to that. Anyway, you're going to hear a bit of that, and I think we're going to have to do most of it on Sunday when I'm likely to be back talking to you again. So here we go.
It's noon on October 5th. I'm here at the division of Phase 2 and Phase 3. No, Phase 3 and Phase 4. And there's still some folks who are kind of moving stuff out. I'm counting about six or seven folks. A lot of tents are still up.
And again, this is in the Phase 4 area. The fence that was dividing off essentially the barren area, that's the demolished areas of Phase 1 and 2 and 3, from the still, at that point, occupied area of Phase 4, was right next to one of the stairways where we had also set up a little kind of a stand that said, encourage people to sign up to help people stop further Benchlands demolitions in the future, possibly to find plaintiffs for a temporary restraining order, lawsuit. Didn't get much response, though I did learn that I think speaking out loudly did encourage people, and that's what I did eventually, but here's some of the, well, what happened before and when we first arrived.
It looks like many of them are still, I don't know if they're occupied or not. Flyer, this is if you want to avoid the next sweep. Good luck.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Yeah. So for free radio, if you want to feel like it, what's your name?
Xan.
And how long have you lived here?
2 years.
And where are you moving to, if you wish to say?
The city.
And 2 years. So how does it feel after 2 years? What's your sense?
Bittersweet. Bittersweet. The town's amazing.
People are bitter and the sweet.
I'm sad to leave, but happy to go.
Right. I like it. What awaits you in San Francisco?
My assistants and my new friends and new friggin' ventures and whatever else I'm not.
Well, you're smiling, that's for sure.
I'm excited.
How much of your stuff are you going to have to abandon?
All of it.
And what will that involve? What would you estimate is the worth of the property you're abandoning?
Everything.
So is all it right. $50,000, $5,000,
$2,000,
$100, $10 cents?
Everything, nothing.
Hard to estimate?
Just time.
Yeah. Time is what you put into it.
Yeah, I'm okay with letting things go.
How has living been here in the encampment?
It's been real. It's been fun.
Has it been real fun?
It's been fairly fun.
Fairly fun?
Yeah, it's good. Community's good. I mean, everybody's, you know, really gets along and loves each other and for the most part. And we, you know, make each other tough and keep each other, you know, supported. And
before we go any further, are you satisfied, because they're about to kick everybody out of this area? It's noon. Are
yes.
You, would you like me to stop talking to you so you can do what you need to do?
Oh, I'm fine. I have nothing to do. I'm already taken care of.
Okay. Well, then let me continue a couple more questions. You're an attractive woman, at least to me you are. So
yeah, it doesn't make it difficult.
So what does that do for you here in the encampment? How did that? What did that mean for you?
Strength.
Really?
Yeah.
And so did you find you could use it as an asset, or was it more a drawback?
It's an asset. I mean, it's a strength building and humbleness. And
were you abused as either physically?
Never been abused.
So you know how to defend yourself?
Yes.
has that been required here?
To an extent, yeah.
Yeah? And what's your sense of the women generally in the encampment, how they do?
They feel okay. They're tough. They handle their own for the most part. Some of them are booed up, but, you know, they're all happy to be young and free and friggin', you know. And I'm pretty sure a lot of them are in search of romance. Friggin'.
And have you found romance here?
Of course. My honey's over there.
Take it.
Yeah.
And is he going to San Francisco as well?
I think so. I do believe, yeah.
So that's one of the reasons you're smiling.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
I forgot to kiss him on the way out. Well, just seen him.
I'll give him a kiss as I go.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Maybe I'll throw it from a distance.
Uh-huh.
I'm a little homophobic myself.
Mm-hmm.
So anything, any unusual experiences in the encampment you want to comment on that's happened to you? Anything that stands out? You're smiling, but
yeah, it's all good.
It's all good.
For me, it is. For others, it could be different, but I'm good.
Now, were you in camp before this, like 2 years?
Yeah, Boise, Idaho.
And did you get the benefit of the Boise decision when it came down? The Boise decision, which said that they can't give you tickets unless they can offer you a place to go.
Which was with the homeless versus freedom.
Yeah, Boise versus homeless versus Boise. It was Martin versus Boise.
Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had shelters and whatnot, which is an offering of a housing. There wasn't too many out on the streets. I was the only female on the streets, and in the winter and the cold. But
how long were you? Had you been on the streets in Boise?
About a year, or half a year.
And before that, you had housing, or?
On the streets, bouncing.
You're a long-time streetster, then.
I am a long-time streetster, yep.
And when was the last time you were actually in housing?
Before Boise, I was in a trailer. I had a trailer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you looking for that, or are you comfortable with just being outside?
I'm looking for a castle or a mansion or something. Or a beach home or something.
Well, I wish you luck in finding that. Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to add? That's...
Oh, yeah, actually, there's a house over here. It's really nice. It has a nice
move in. Is that it? But you're going to San Francisco.
Right? Possibilities are endless.
Mm-hmm. Nicely put. Anything you want to add?
I just hope that the community outside this community and can come to terms with respect for each other and welcoming of each other and freaking learn to get along and freaking, because it's a beautiful blessing I have to be able to live in this city, freaking, especially Santa Cruz, and the way I get to live.
Or it was until you moved to San Francisco.
I'd still be able to if I wanted.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Have you been moving from encampment to encampment in this, in the benchlands?
It's nice. I get freshed up, you know, make a new home every time I move.
Well, I'm played out. Anything else you want to add?
I'm good.
All right. Thank you for talking with me. And again, we've been talking with?
Xan.
Xan? How do you spell that?
Xan.
Thank you, Xan.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a little bit of the conversation I had overlooking the demolition as it pretty quickly began after noon on Wednesday, yesterday. And I was joined by Joy Schindeldecker, who's, of course, running for mayor of Santa Cruz. She's also part of Santa Cruz Cares, which I think is a much more important part of her her activities, her activism, at least from my perspective. She also was part of the lawsuit that helped to stop, at least temporarily, the oversized vehicle ordinance as part of Santa Cruz Cares. Anyway, here's some of the observations that I and others were making as they began to demolish the encampment yesterday.
And it's now about 12:10, and I'm still in the infamous fourth phase, which includes the electrical pickups, which I'm not sure how they're going to deal with eliminating the pickups. But there's been no police.
And what that means is there was a board where people could plug in their phones and get some electrical connection to charge their phones, which is essentially a requirement because people were being sent by the jail down to this area, as well as from other encampments. And some folks were on probation. I don't know about parole, but they had conditions that required them to check in, and they had to be able to do that. And that required some kind of phone access. And so that was, I think it might have been provided through the actual original settlement that the Union of the Homeless got with the city when it made the original camp, which was then much smaller, in March of 2021. But this electrical situation has now been cut short because they're going to have to either move it or lose it. And I don't think it's nobody was moving it that I was aware of when this destruction was happening yesterday. But I suppose they could move it subsequently. Perhaps they have. I don't know. I'm likely to find out in the days ahead.
Yet, who've shown up. And there are still folks kind of collecting on the path. There's still a food tent set up for people to eat.
And the food tent was set up on the pathway above the benchland, sort of serving grilled cheese sandwiches and hot dogs, a little energy food to help the folks. I called it the Last Supper, although it wasn't much of a supper, the Last Lunch. Anyway.
Food tent set up for people to eat. Grilled cheese sandwiches and hot dogs. Folks are wheeling away their property. Some folks are stacking it up in green buckets or brown, black buckets. And seems a little more laid back than the Phase 3 demolition. And the cops are descending, you say. What's going on, Gloria?
Cops just went down here, and they're encouraging people to move along. How's this guy going to get his cart up from there?
That's a good question. I noticed there's also an area closed, no entry sign that's been posted at the bottom of the stairway there.
Oh, yeah.
Which means it probably is stopping people from coming in. I was just saying it looked like a more laid-back area, but I was at the other end, and I didn't see at the other end of Phase 3 when they were doing this last week. They kind of kept it open, and they're still keeping it open so people can go more deeper into the benchlands and crowd everyone else out. Yeah, they were doing that.
Where did they get through? Is there an opening?
There's an opening.
I see the
opening in the fence?
Yeah. Yeah. And Jeremy stopped by, and he asked Greg to tell people that who are dissing him on, or he calls throwing him under the bus on social media, that he's not a bad guy.
Right.
Well, Greg got a bite, and he had to go to emergency.
When was this?
Last time.
I see he's got a bandage on his left arm.
He said.
Yeah, he was actually at the meeting on Monday, so he's.
And we're talking about Greg Benson, who you heard earlier in an interview, who's sort of actively about. He's been a longtime Huff member who's been living in the benchlands and showing up for the. Actually, I don't know. I can't recall seeing him at the previous demolitions, but he might have been there, and I was only there for short periods of time.
Surviving. I see you're the individual.
He has a place now at Coral Street.
I know. That's what he was saying. It's apparently upscale. It's not just a. It's not just a pallet. And no, this was before he got his injury. They gave it to him, which he suggested, and I think Keith suggested at the meeting, the Food Not Bombs meeting and the Benchlands Resistance meeting, was in order to winnow away the activists, because Greg, in his own way, is an activist.
Yeah.
I see Joy of the city council candidate race is still running. It's still here.
Nice talk.
What did you learn from Joy Schindeldecker?
Well, she's working with mutual aid groups.
Here comes the bulldozer.
Oh, crap.
Bulldozer and the clutcher. The police have just opened up the gates so the bulldozer can come rolling in and start grabbing the tents.
Yeah. Is that the police dismantling a tent over there, the one that's raised?
I don't know who's dismantling it.
If there's a waiting list at the armory, then somebody needs to drop a pro se TRO immediately.
And this is Greg, who's, again, himself looking for a TRO, temporary restraining order, to stop this Benchlands demolition, and who also is a volunteer to be a plaintiff.
Somebody who can assist with that, you know, using the Chico or the...
Well, that's the question. And right now we have nobody has signed up that I can see.
Somebody that
Joy signed up.
I've got somebody that lives here that would probably do that. But who do we have that could help?
Well, that's what we're trying to do. That's why we came out here today, to get people's names. That's why I was distributing that flyer.
Initiate a TRO.
Oh, this minute? Well, you need to have somebody who knows how to write it. And you need to have somebody who's willing to be the individual.
Yeah, right.
And that would be somebody who's a plaintiff.
Yep.
That's all you need.
I have...
Well, if you do, you need to call me and stay in touch. The problem is it's hard to be in touch with you.
I know. Yeah.
And
my phone that I'd borrowed from somebody got stolen when I was in the hospital. So,
it can be a problem. I see the first clutches of the bulldozer going into phase four through the gate. It's pretty bad because, of course, these are people's homes that are being destroyed.
Yeah. I've had great conversations. I've been fed and just had wonderful interactions with humans that live in those homes.
Now, your home is in phase five. Is that where that's
the next phase? Yeah.
But you've also been winnowed out. I was saying before that they've kind of coaxed you away. The authorities have given you a place in the shelter, so you will not be perhaps as effective an organizer.
I went through the procedure. I think I probably got something slightly sweeter than I would have expected, but I did go to the procedure. I did just normal human stuff and did get a place. I know there's people that are not finding places that have freedom of movement or anything. Right now there's a waiting list even for the jail camp up at the golf course. I just call it jail camp because if you have to be in at 8 p.m. and you can't leave, even to touch a blade of grass or touch a tree, squeeze a squirrel, you can't do that between...
I think that's he's talking about the overlook next to the armory encampment up in De La Vega or up in the Gulf Lands. It used to be called the Gulf Lands. Now it's the overlook. Or as he calls it, the jail camp, which I haven't been up to see, so... Maybe it's only the jail camp to some and a happy time camp or at least shelter from a storm to others.
8 a.m. or 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. You're locked in there because you get brought there in a van and you leave there in a van or worse.
Or an ambulance like you did the other day.
Yeah.
You get ambulanced with your injury at your arm?
Yeah. It was my friends put a tourniquet on it and had it pretty well squozen. So
the doggy
blood...
who bit you?
Yeah. Yep. Dog with a large head, oversized mouth, even larger teeth.
So did he enjoy the meal?
Well, he's going to wait till he meets dessert, because I'm going to go have a little discussion with him about dessert. But I'm nice, you know, I'm humane. But there's this conversation is not over.
So, again, we see the bulldozer moving into phase four and kind of scooping up. I guess it's... Well, I can't see it. It's blocked by other tents. But
Robert, I need to drop some.
I'll let you go.
We've
been talking.
I'll chat. Greg Bengtson.
Thanks, Greg.
And that's just about all we have time for at the moment. We're going to go out on a song about nuclear war, actually, from olden times. I guess it's from the 60s. It's called The Sun is Burning by Simon and Garfunkel in the album Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m.
The sun is burning in the sky. Strands of clouds go slowly drifting by. In the park, the lazy bees are droning in the flowers among the trees. And the sun burns in the sky.
Was released in 1964. Some of the notes say online, originally written and recorded by British folk artist Ian Campbell a year earlier. The Sun is Burning figures prominently on Simon and Garfunkel's debut album and is the most well-known version of the song. Interestingly, I'd never heard of it, although I've heard, of course, many times Simon and Garfunkel's albums. Campbell wrote The Sun is Burning to get fellow folkies aboard on taking a stand against nuclear warfare, which would be very nice if somebody started doing that now, wouldn't it? And felt strongly enough to donate some of the money he made on the tune to the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And again, that song is The Sun is Burning by Simon and Garfunkel. That's it for this edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. If you think you want to help with a TRO around Benchlands or stopping the sweeps generally until there is a real and not a pretextual shelter availability, then give me a call at 831-423-4833. I'm encouraging people to get together thinking that if there are some of us who want to do it, maybe we might actually do it. We'll see. Again, 831-423-4833. Thanks for listening.